This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest tonight holds the unique distinction of being the only musician to appear on every Grammy Award-winning jazz record by both Wynton and Branford Marsalis, one of the most in-demand drummers in the world. Let's go to Harlem now and meet Steelers fan Jeff Tane Watts. Jeff, great to see you.
Hey, it's great to be on the show and great to have you. Thank you.
Well, one of the reasons that we wanted to have you on the show, not only all your accomplishments in jazz, but gee, when you're a Steeler fan, you have to be on this show because we'll share some Steeler memories as we go through. You and I went through basically the same period in Pittsburgh watching the great Steeler team. So, Jeff Tane Watts. Kenny Kirkland gave you that nickname, I understand. Take us back to that day and how this stuck, because you use Tane Watts, you use Tane in a lot of different, you use it for albums, you use it for references, your website. How did this all start?
Yeah, I was in Florida with Wynton Marsalis back in 1983, and we were on tour, and we had an off day where we had to travel between West Palm Beach and Miami. Like, I don't know, that's not a far drive. But anyway, we were driving and sharing rental cars. So myself and the late, great Kenny Kirkland, we were cruising. And we came upon a gas station that had, as its logo, it had a profile of a Native American wearing a headdress. And it was called Chieftain Gas. And so he liked to play around with language. And so he said, Chief Tane, you're going to be Jeff Tane. I said, no, I'm not. But it was too late and it stuck.
It really stuck. And you like it, too. You can tell because you use it.
I use it, but I will tell the listeners, there's a lot of songs with Tane in the title, but most of them are written by other people. Like Branford is written like maybe four of them. And, you know, the guitarist Paul Ballenbach has one and Courtney Pine has one. And, you know, like different people write them for me.
What a tremendous sideman you have been for the Marsalises. You've played on for both of them and Grammy Award winning albums on both sides. What is it about playing with the Marsalises that you have enjoyed to go from Wynton and then to Branford?
They're really cool people, and it feels like family the whole time, and you know, they've had a lot of success, so it's easy for people to, you know, try to hate on them, but you can't really do it because they're really, 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 really good people, really, really serious about music, and you know, and they're not afraid to speak their mind. You know, it's cool, and at least you know where they're coming from. So that's it.
Drummers always seem to have a beat in their head. When did that beat develop for you?
I don't know. Everybody tells me I was always beating on stuff around the house. But I always tell the story, like, whenever I was in fourth grade, it was time to select an instrument. And so they came to us and they said, "What do you want to play?" And even though I already had, like, a little toy drum set around the house that my family got me, I wanted to play the trumpet. And to this day, I feel like the teacher ran out of trumpets, but he didn't want to break my heart. So he told me that my teeth were incorrect for playing the trumpet and that I should choose something else. And so I chose the drums.
Do you remember the name of that teacher?
Oh, what's his name? Mr. Shannon or something like that, yeah.
So maybe we should thank Mr. Shannon because we wouldn't have this fabulous drummer then if it wasn't for his kind of fake teeth story, huh?
That's right. I gotta write a song for blues for Mr. Shannon. It's coming up soon. No.
You were born in Pittsburgh.
Born in Pittsburgh. I was born in Allegheny General Hospital, and I grew up mostly in the Hill District, Sugar Top in the Hill District, Bryn Mawr Road. And whenever I got to junior high school, we moved out to North Versailles, PA, Crestus Terrace, and I graduated from East Allegheny High School.
What is it about Pittsburgh and jazz? There are so many great artists that have come from the Pittsburgh area. Why is that?
I think it's a no-nonsense place, and I think that people work hard all week, and whenever they go to hear some music, it better be right, Or else they're going to tell you about it. If it's supposed to be funky, it better be funky. And if it's supposed to be swinging or blues or whatever it is, if somebody that's been working in the mill all day, you know, puts their money down and is coming to have a drink somewhere, it's got to be kind of right. You know, it's just a really real place. I don't know. But, I mean, it took me a long time to even realize how many great, great jazz musicians were from Pittsburgh. You know, it's as many as anywhere. It's as many as from Philadelphia or Chicago or New Orleans. You know, it's kind of special.
I kind of feel like there's pressure on me because my saxophone is still sitting in a case and I can't play it very well, Jeff. So that I'm letting the city down a little bit by not being able to play. A lot of people know you for various things. They know you for being in Mo' Better Blues, you know, Spike Lee's terrific film. And what was that like working for Spike?
Spike was really cool. It was fun being around the guys. For about 40 days during the week, I was around, you know, Denzel Washington. I'm proud of the fact that I had billing over Samuel L. Jackson at the time, so that was kind of cool. Wesley Snipes used to come and pick me up every day, like 5:30 in the morning. We'd go to the shoot, and I'd try to do some music gigs at night, and, you know, he was really cool. Giancarlo Esposito, Spike was great. Denzel was funny and really into pulling off the trumpet thing, you know, making it realistic. Everybody was really, really cool. It was great to interface with some artists from another perspective. And so they would try to help me with acting, and I would try to give them a little insight into the jazzy life.
Yeah, we find out a lot on Sports Jam that everybody wants to be somebody else at times. So I'm sure they wanted to, you know, help me out. How do you drum like that, right?
Yeah, I'll tell you, we used to go out at night and go to clubs. And, you know, Denzel was just starting to get really, really famous, and Wesley Snipes was unknown. And they would go to clubs, and they would bring their instruments with them. And so I would take them to, like, Sweet Basil or some of the clubs, and they'd have their horns, and I would just introduce them anonymously. I would say, yeah, this is my man Wes. He's from the Bronx. He plays saxophone, man. He's bad. And this is D. It would be Denzel. I said, this is D, man. He's from Mount Vernon, man. He's great. He's a bad trumpet player. And people would offer them gigs. Like Wesley Snipes gave a couple of people his number, and this cat wants to call me for this Latin gig, man. It's really cool, man. You know, but they're fun to hang with.
That's great stuff. That's great stuff. You played Rhythm Jones. For those who haven't got to see the movie, you can see, you know, that's a great thing about today. You can go and watch any movie you want. Tell us about Rhythm Jones.
Rhythm Jones was supposed to be based on me a little bit. I think, you know, I wasn't really hip to developing character and giving him more of a backstory. So they tried to give me something. You know, I was trying to meet chicks, and I think there were some clues. They left some clues around, but I didn't put my character together very well. But on his dressing room mirror, you know, there's like pictures of scantily clad women. So I guess he's kind of a freak. But, you know, a lot of him didn't really come out. But it was, you know, it was fun. I wish I could do it again, because now I could tap into projecting more of myself, you know, through the character. But I mean, a great experience being a part of that.
And of course, a lot of people know you for being the drummer with Jay Leno on the Tonight Show. That's a whole kind of different thing, isn't it?
Yeah, TV is TV, and I mean, at the time, I was kind of not resistant to it, but I hadn't quite gotten over my New York jazz musician fix yet. So I was kind of in denial. And, you know, for the first few months, myself and Kenny Kirkland, we would jump on planes every weekend and come back to New York and try to live the jazzy life. But after a while, it became a job. It became a job, and, you know, drive to work and work with the same people every day. And then you start to see a pattern to the shows. You know, you see like, man, wasn't Gilbert Gottfried just on like 2-3 weeks ago or something? You know, you start to see like the rotation of the guests and stuff like that. And I wasn't quite prepared for the LA lifestyle. But now that I have a family, I would be more more prone to settle down into that thing. But it was a great experience, and Jay was really, really cool, really, really funny. You know, we'd go to his house for Thanksgiving, and the other stuff that's funny is, like, on the show, since we're talking about Pittsburgh a little bit, I would adorn my drum kit with various pennants from the Pirates and from the Penguins and the Steelers. So everybody that came on the show, they knew I was from Pittsburgh. And so there's one, like, who came on? Michael Keaton came on the show. And, like, they would finish the show. Jay would be like, good night. And he would come right over to me. He's like, what part of town are you from? Blah, blah, blah. I think he's from Mount Lebanon or somewhere. I forget exactly where he's from. And then there was another time where we did a skit with Lynn Swann. And so Lynn Swann is at the rehearsal, and he's hanging out. And Kevin Eubanks and all the guys are, like, you know, giving me some stuff. They're like, hey, this guy, he's always talking about Pittsburgh, this drummer, man. He talks about him too much, man. You know, what do you think about that? And Lynn Swann was like, hey, well, we did get 4 Super Bowls. I mean, you can't really say much about it, you know. But it was a great experience, though.
Bradshaw is deep, and they're firing downfield. Swann going after covered, and it's juggled. Swann catches another circus catch inside the Dallas 45-yard line. Gets up and goes inside the 40, down to the 37-yard line. Had a defensive player right on his back in Mark Washington. The ball bounced into the air. Swann lying on his back, cut the ball in circus fashion, got up and ran again, went down inside the 40, down to the 38-yard line. A sensational catch for the Steelers, Lynn Swann.
We're speaking with Jeff Tane Watts here on Sports Jam, a big Steelers fan. You mentioned the Lynn Swann part of the 4 Super Bowls. We got some real sad news recently with the passing of L.C. Greenwood. That leaves one guy on the front four of the Steel Curtain defense. Joe Green's it. He's it because Ernie Holmes and Dwight White, and now the great L.C. Greenwood has passed away. That makes me sad. How about you?
I was sad when I heard that because I was you know, part time. I live in Easton, so I was at in Easton, Pennsylvania. So I was down there, and I was at a sports bar, watching us get beaten by that was the Minnesota game. So I was watching the game, and then I found out about 2/3 of the way through the game that he had passed. And, you know, I saw, like, another Steeler fan across the bar, and I was like, man, L.C. Greenwood's gone, man. That's a drag, man. You know, because, I mean, I just loved those classic teams so much, you know, and just top to bottom, the whole roster. And you know, and I've gotten to meet quite a few of the guys, too, and that was a drag.
Yeah. And during our teen years, we saw maybe the greatest football team to ever play.
Pretty much the greatest pro football of the modern era. And people will try to cry. I mean, no one can really compare. No one can really compare. And we had the great defense. We had, you know, had Blyer and Franco Harris both having 1,000 yards in the same season, you know, winning the Super Bowl when the Pirates won the World Series. There's, like, so many things. And that's why people that aren't Steeler fans, they get really disgusted because we have too much to brag about, too much to talk about. It's cool. Steeler Nation.
We're from Midtown Green, the Super Bowl team. We cheer the Pittsburgh Steelers. Chuck Noll and all his friends are all on the beam. Go out and get them Steelers.
You used the word compare. Let's do a little comparison. Who is... Let's talk about those Steelers, those Super Bowl teams in the 70s. Who's the Jeff Tane Watts of the Steelers? Who do you compare yourself to as far as being a part of, you know, being part of the band? And are you the leader? Are you the sideman more? Who is that person?
Who is that person? I guess I would have to be kind of like the Jack Lambert of the squad. You know, it's like I'm doing a lot of the dirty work for guys, and, you know, but I can still have a pretty serious effect over the, you know, on the outcome of the game.
That's a pretty good guy to pick. That's Hall of Fame.
That's right. No, that's right. Man, I dig them so much. But I can give you, like, just a few Steeler stories. One is I was playing in Pittsburgh with Wynton Marsalis at this club called Harper's downtown. Walt Harper, the pianist, had this club. And who came to the gig? Art Rooney and Dan Rooney and Chuck Noll. So I got to meet them. That's one great thing. The other thing is I played with Wynton at the Super Bowl between the Bears and the Patriots, whenever that was, like 87 or something like that. So we're in the Superdome, and we're going to play the national anthem before the game. So I'm in the holding area, and it was like, it was Pittsburgh heaven, because they always have all the MVPs from every Super Bowl. They have them make a little lap around the field. So I was in the booth. We're in there, like a room, like maybe double the size of this bedroom here. I'm in there with Tony Dorsett from Hopewell High in Pittsburgh. I'm in there with Joe Namath, Joe Montana from Ringgold High School in Pittsburgh. Of course, Lynn Swann. Of course, Terry Bradshaw. You know, Joe, yeah, it's like the cats. Joe Namath. It was crazy. It was crazy. Really, really beautiful. Just hanging out. And Winton is like, yeah, man, this guy, he's from Pittsburgh, man. And they're all just like laughing. And it was really cool.
Some people have seen a drum set that was all Steelers, but that's not actually your set, is it?
It's not my set. It's made by this company, DW. I guess you can send them a logo and they'll customize a kit. But I think I owe it to myself to at least have a snare drum designed. Now I'm going to do that.
You're listening to Sports Jam on WBGO, The Jazz Source. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest tonight is Grammy Award-winning drummer Jeff Tane Watts, who's also a big Pittsburgh Steelers fan. Let's head back up to his place in Harlem and talk more about football and music with Jeff Tane Watts here on Sports Jam. Did you play sports in high school?
I wrestled a little bit, and I tried to play football. I played like football in the ninth grade, and then I started to focus more on music. But I played offensive guard. And I played defensive tackle for 1 year.
Not bad.
Yeah.
So as a wrestler, then I'm not going to mess with you then, am I?
I think I wasn't the greatest wrestler. You know, there's a different kind of intimacy going on there that I couldn't participate in. But it's cool. It's cool. It was fun, though.
Since you mentioned how you wanted to play the trumpet, so I think I know the answer to this. But so then football came before drumming for you.
Pretty much my awareness that we had a great team. I mean, you know, until I really got in junior high school and high school, it was just like really music was kind of just like another activity, like, you know, staying after intramural basketball and music class and, you know, band class and stuff like that. I didn't really think about it as a lifestyle until like maybe the 10th grade. Yeah.
When did Jeff Tane Watts know that, you know, you had an ability that put you above the rest?
I guess when I got to high school, maybe like ninth grade, 10th grade, you know, I mean, this is something that's related to drumming, but it's more of an overall musical ability. So I was born with perfect pitch, and I just never knew it, and I thought it was something that everybody could do. And you know, I could always tell when the reel-to-reel tape deck was slowing down, and I could always hear when songs were in a key different from what they were known to be in, you know, like the correct key. But I just assumed that everybody could do it. And so when I got in ninth or 10th grade, one of my teachers, they came to me and they said, you know what, you're born with perfect pitch. You can just hear pitch just naturally, and one in 10,000 people has this thing. And whatever. And I said, okay, cool. But still, you know, music was something that I enjoyed doing, nice group activity. But then at a certain point, my teachers told my parents that I should consider doing it.
So you really were blessed then.
Yeah, I'm blessed and fortunate the whole way. Great teachers, great people around me always.
What's the solo on what tune is the ultimate Jeff Tane Watts drum solo?
I mean, a lot of people enjoy, I guess there's a video that's on YouTube. It's probably one of the first clips that comes up, and I'm wearing like a white dress shirt, but it's basically the Branford Marsalis Quartet, and we're playing the music from John Coltrane's Love Supreme, and I take a long drum solo in there, and a lot of people enjoy that.
What's the difference in being a leader and being a sideman?
Mostly in the preparation, because I mean when it's time for me to play, I'm kind of unconscious. I really want to get lost in the music and just react to things like just instinctively and not have to think about anything. So the difference being the leader, I mean, when I do my gigs, mostly I'm playing music that I've arranged and composed. Mostly my compositions these days. And so, you know, a lot of the responsibility is out front, just like making sure the musicians have the music and we know where we're going to start and where we're going to end, so that once we get in the moment, I'm free to just play. And at that point, it's like I'm playing somebody else's music or something. You know, it's like I really want to be just like another person in the band trying to get the whole thing going.
You mentioned the word unconscious. It reminds me of what, you know, in athletic terms is when they talk about being in the zone. When somebody like Jordan was in the zone, didn't have to think, that ball was just off the fingertips and everything was, you know, nothing but twine.
Mm-hmm. It happens a lot. It happens like that with music. And I think music, you play it all the time and, you practice and you work on stuff and you study stuff. But the thing that keeps you going is when the zone happens, and it doesn't happen all the time. Like you play and you can have good shows and everything can be right, but every once in a while there's a time, you know, when the music kind of plays itself. It kind of plays itself and your hands are just going and you're not even really conscious of what's going on, but everything is working. And you know, it's just like some energy comes down and gets you, and that's what keeps you going. Because you live for those moments. So you do gigs and you do all the other stuff just so you can be in the vicinity and be able to tap into those times.
You mentioned energy. Even though you're from Pittsburgh, we're here doing the Sports Jam in Harlem. Do you get an energy being in Harlem, knowing all the history of this area?
Completely. I mean, I was in Brooklyn for like a long time, and I just relocated here and also to Easton. And this was pretty much the first neighborhood I lived in New York, like just down the hill in Washington Heights. And, you know, I just always thought it was good property and good, great neighborhoods and a lot of, you know, diversity, of course. And then if you even think about the history at all, I feel like this is a place that I should be. And it's really funny because I grew up in the Hill District in Pittsburgh, which was kind of the Sugar Hill of Pittsburgh, with, you know, people like Art Blakey and a lot of the cats were from that area. And so now I've ended up in the proper Sugar Hill, and I think it's really appropriate.
Who did you listen to when you first started thinking that jazz was going to be your genre of music?
Well, let me see. I mean, I came out of a classical thing and a FM radio, R&B thing, WAMO, and, you know, progressive rock on WDVE in Pittsburgh and stuff like that. I came out of that, and I started to listen to my brother James. He was a student at the University of Pittsburgh, like when I was maybe like a sophomore in high school. And so he started working at a record store, this place called Flo's Records on Bouquet Street in Oakland, like right up the street from the original hot dog place or whatever. And so he started to bring home fusion records of the day, fusion records from the 70s. So I started to listen to like Herbie Hancock and the Headhunters and the Mahavishnu Orchestra. You know, I got hip to Billy Cobham and Lenny White and people like that. And I started to listen to that and Chick Corea's music and all that stuff. And the more I found out about the music, I just kind of did a backtrack thing. So I was like, oh man, so Chick Corea played with this guy named Miles Davis. Let me check out Miles Davis. So I started checking him out. And then it was like, you know, well, Miles Davis played with this guy named Charlie Parker. Who is this? You know, and whatever. And I'm still backtracking to this day. And, you know, but instantly, other than Fusion, I definitely got inspired from Charlie Parker's music, from John Coltrane's music, later on Monk's music and Duke Ellington's music and Sun Ra, you know, from the avant-garde that was around in the late 70s, like the Art Ensemble Chicago and different things, you know. And to this day, I'm backtracking in jazz, trying to stay current, and I try to research a lot of world music, you know, just like music from Western and Central Africa and India and things like that.
Where is jazz right now?
Jazz is in a funny little spot. It's in a place where I never thought it would be. It's like, it just feels like a portion of the population wants to do like a reset. And I mean, there's something admirable about that. But I just feel like there's always been the core of the music and the tradition, and then there's always been something else. You know, I mean, there was bebop, but then there was Dizzy Gillespie with Chano Pozo, or there was Stan Getz with the Brazilians, and there was Miles Davis doing what he did. And I don't think he ever wanted to be disconnected from the core. It was always an alternative. But now I think I just feel like a backlash against tradition, and I don't feel like tradition should end. That I just feel like there should be alternatives, and that, you know, we should be inclusive. But I just hear like some younger musicians talk like swinging should be done or whatever. I don't think any dance or rhythm or groove should ever be gone, you know. And I think that any groove is new if you're playing it well, you know. I mean, you know, if somebody's swinging really, really swinging, like Frankie Dunlop with Thelonious Monk, or like Papa Joe Jones, or like, you know, John Coltrane's band, if somebody's really, really swinging and writing new music and things like that, I don't think it's, you know, that will never be old. But, you know, but I like everything. And I like, you know, there's at least people are talking about the music. They're talking about it and talking about what they think it should be. And, you know, so it's better than not discussing it at all.
I don't know how many of their cats that you just talked about, how many cats you just talked about actually were able to sneak in their favorite team on an album cover. But Jeff Tane Watts was able to do that, as he had the terrible towel on Branford's Bragtown. That caught the eye of some people.
Definitely. I think somebody put it in my Wikipedia. But yeah, it was really funny to do it. I kind of snuck it into the photo session. And actually, that we took that picture at a minor league baseball stadium that's in the locker room of the Durham Bulls. Yeah, I guess that inspired the film Bull Durham, of course, or whatever. So we were there, and I just kind of snuck it in, and Branford saw it. And a related terrible towel story. What was I doing? I played at Carnegie Mellon University. No, it was a function for Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. So I was playing at the Carnegie Music Hall in Oakland. And the announcer for the event was Bill Hillgrove, the voice of the Steelers, amongst others, and stuff like that. So we finished the gig, and he came to me and he said, you know what? I hang out with Mike Tomlin all the time, you know, and he likes music. You know, why don't you send him a CD? I said, okay. And I signed a CD, and I gave it to Bill. And he said, you know what? I'm going to get you a towel signed by Tomlin. I'm going to get it for you. And I was like, cool. He said, maybe some players, but at least he'll have signed it. And I said, okay. And I didn't even think about it. And then like maybe like 5 months later, I was working at Birdland. And I finished the first set, and I walked off, and Bill Hillgrove was out there with his wife. He's like, come here, come here, come here, Watts. And I said, yeah, what's going on? What's going on? And he hands me a shopping bag. I'm like, man, what is, thank you. He's like, I see, you forgot already. You forgot already. And I was like, and he got me, yeah. So he got me a terrible towel signed by Mike Tomlin, and I have it framed.
That's great. And for those who aren't familiar with the Steelers broadcast, Bill Hillgrove was the partner of Myron Cope, whose idea it was to have the terrible towel.
Steelers defense is brutal. All at the National Guard.
Does it have magical powers, Jeff?
It can. It can. It's not infallible, but you have to believe. You have to believe. I kind of slipped on my talismanship the past few years, and I feel I can trace that to some of the recent decline of the Steelers. So I kind of let my game I feel like I let the team down a little bit. So I'm back on the case with the towel.
And Bill Hillgrove, I understand he is a big Jazz fan, so I'm not surprised to hear the connection that you two made.
They're back. He throws the pass up. It's going to be picked off. James Harrison has it. He's running up the sideline. 25-30, 35-40. Still on his feet at the 45 and down. No, he's still on his feet. Here comes Harrison jumping over people to the 20, the 15, the 10, the 5. And that's a touchdown for Pittsburgh. An amazing play by James Harrison.
You went to Duquesne. You mentioned a classical background, and then Berklee School of Music. So you know you have great roots and you have great genes, don't you?
Definitely, definitely. Come from a rich, rich tradition of music and football, and it was great going to Berklee like in 1979 because it was that's the year when the Pirates and the Steelers both won. And I was just bragging all over the place, and Branford Marcellus was in school with me, and he was really hating that, really, oh man, stop talking about Pittsburgh, man, it's terrible. And who was up there? Frank Lacy, who is from Houston, the great trombonist Frank Lacy. So, I mean, we were having those epic battles with the Oilers and Earl Campbell back in the day. You know, it was just a really, I came up at the perfect time.
Have you ever written a song with the Steelers in mind?
I haven't yet, but I'm going to. I'm definitely going to write something. I've been trying to think of something that's cool. That's really cool for them. They deserve a song.
So I like to ask these type of questions toward the end of interviews. If you have an opportunity to go back in time, what concert, what club would you like to see and somebody performing, and what sporting event would you have liked to have been at?
Woo! I'll say any club that John Coltrane's quartet was playing in. I would love to just be in that room for like 20 minutes and just feel all those very strong sounds, potent sounds in action. That's one thing. And about sports, I guess I would have liked to be at a game, and this is because I just saw him talking to somebody yesterday on television. I guess Mike Tyson has this thing based on his life, and they've put it on cable and stuff like that. So one of the episodes, he's interviewing Jim Brown. So I would love to have seen Jim Brown in person playing at his best.
I think we might agree on that one. Jim Brown was a great guest here on Sports Jam. And thanks for letting us come into your place here in Harlem and sharing not only the music stories, but stories about the Steelers.
Yeah, this is a win-win for me. It's all good, and I appreciate you guys checking me out. I had a great time.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out the podcast version of this show by going to WBGO.org/SportsJam or find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes. My guest next Wednesday night at 7:30 will be U.S. Olympic bobsled hopeful Jasmine Fenlater. We'll get an update on her career and how things are going at Lake Placid. Join us next Wednesday night, and until then, I'll see you at the game. Check out the podcast version of the show by going to WBGO.org/SportsJam or find us